And welcome to Coach and the Doctor, not a real coach, not a real doctor. Hello, Doctor.
Hello, Coach. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I suppose I should get the credit in. I'm never quite sure when we drop credits in this show, but you can never be too nice to your sponsors.
So you don't know when to drop credits into a show?
Well, I do know when to drop credits in the show, but I don't know whether I'm dropping too many. And bosses used to love me because when I was working on radio, I used to give away ads. And when I can tell you a story, when I used to do mid dawns in Canberra,
you can tell me a story, but I don't want to.
Yeah,
really,
I'm going to tell
it.
You. In the old days, in mid dawn in Canberra, or mid dawns as we used to call them, which was midnight till 6 a.m. And of course, that was before they pre-recorded shows. I can remember, and I wanted to be a real rock and roll disc jockey. So when you're doing mid dawns, you know, you're thinking, who's listening?
No one.
No one. But I wanted to get really good at it. So I wanted to sound like a jock. So when you're doing a drive shift or an afternoon shift, you play two-minute blocks of commercials. So I used to play in mid-dawns. I used to do 3 two-minute blocks of commercials, and they were all free.
That's because you didn't want to talk and you were sleeping half the time, so it was all automated.
I wanted to sound like a real jock, like I was working on a real radio station, which it was. 2CC at that time was fantastic. But welcome along.
Thank you, Coach.
Week in disability, do you have a story for me or not?
A week in disability. Yeah, look, I've got a story I don't really like this week. There's been a lot of talk. There's always talk about rorting the NDIS system.
Yep.
It's been in the news. I guess it hits the headlines once every couple of weeks. I saw it firsthand this week. I discovered it with the participant. I suspected it was going on through another organisation. After talking with the participant, talking to the plan manager, looking at invoices and going through the system of what had occurred, there's no doubt that unfortunately this particular participant has had thousands and thousands of dollars taken from their plan, which the provider was not entitled to.
Mm.
Which is just, well, it's disgusting in my opinion, but what makes it even worse for me is that when I spoke to the Quality and Safeguards Commission and to the NDIA about the situation, their response was, you can send an email.
Oh.
Yes, send an email.
With urgent on it, maybe?
Well, they didn't even say urgent. They said you can just send an email to complaints and the fraud department. And I said, well, that's it. And they said, yes, and it will be action. And I said, okay, well, so what happens from there? Basically, the response was, once you've sent the email, it'll, you know, go into the system and somebody will probably get back to you in 3 to 6 months.
Oh, that quick.
I just thought, like, there's a fraud squad that's investigating rorts and yet it'll take 3 to 6 months for anything to happen, for them to start looking at it. Well, jeepers, you know, you could be anywhere in 3 to 6 months.
That's how they explained that away to you, that 3 to 6 months. Is that because, what, there's a backlog?
There is a backlog and they're under-resourced. That's it.
So meanwhile, the NDIS gets criticised for, you know, the rorting within the system, but they're systematically helping that rorting by not actually having enough people to police what's going on.
Correct.
So they're undoing what all the wonderful work they do in one fell swoop by not actually following up what needs to be followed up, because, you know, I'm pretty sure if you're ripping the taxation department off, you've got a lot of people after you then.
Well, absolutely.
Very quickly.
Absolutely. Or if you break into a bank, you're going to get caught pretty quickly, or they're going to investigate it pretty quickly, not wait 3 to 6 months. It was disappointing on both fronts, you know, like the fact that I've seen firsthand a poor participant having money taken out of their plan, who, by the way, now has no funding left and so cannot get any supports for the next 5 months because all the money's been taken out. The NDIS won't do anything about it, and they said for 3 to 6 months.
So you can put in, obviously, a change of circumstance, though, for them and try and get that support in place, or they're just going, well, no, we're not going to help you.
Well, you can, but that's going to take time too.
Yeah, and that's more costs, more time.
And what happens between now and then? And not only that, somebody's just stolen thousands of dollars and we've got proof of it and we just have to wait.
You've obviously put in the required paperwork and stuff like that.
Yep. But not expecting a call.
Well, hopefully in 3 to 6 months we can get on the air and actually tell the story that something's been done about it, but it does seem an inordinate amount of time to have to wait.
Yeah, and look, and so forget about the money that's been taken, the fact that the Quality and Safeguards Commission or the NDIA aren't going to get to it.
Mm.
We've got this poor participant who now has no supports.
Now, a feel-good story on that note is we do have another love match within the organisation. We can't mention names, of course, and I won't mention names, but it's just such a wonderful pairing, isn't it, to see these two people together.
It's a great story. Look, hopefully it lasts, like anything, but they're happy, and hopefully there'll be a J-Man baby coming out, or a J-baby.
A J-baby, eh?
Yeah, well, enough about that. Let's move on with the show today. Who have we got coming up?
Well, we've got a couple of great guests, as I say, every week. We've got Professor Lars Ittner. He's the director of...
Lars?
Ittner, yeah.
Is he German?
Could be. Or Austrian, I would say. He's okay. Probably Austrian.
Oh, only because I'm sure we're going to hear some sort of German story from him.
Oh, from me? You might. I'm going to keep that close to my chest. He's the director of the Dementia Research Centre and Professor in the Department of Biomedical Sciences at the Faculty of Medicine, Health and Human Sciences at Macquarie University. That's pretty much the beginning and the end of the interview. The title's so long. But first up, just after this break, Joe Williams, suicide prevention and wellbeing educator, a former champion, world champion boxer and rugby league player who battled the majority of his life with suicidal ideation and bipolar disorder. So Joe's story is next here on Coaching the Doctor.
When your message is timely, trustworthy, and delivered in a positive environment, it's powerful. That's why sponsors of 89.9 The Light see great results. Visit thelight.com.au.
Ever thought of changing your lifestyle or maybe even your career? But you're a bit nervous about taking the plunge into the unknown. Well, now is the time to get your feet wet. J-Man is an NDIS registered support provider that is now hiring. As the world is adapting to change, it's your time now to not only make a difference, but to also earn the sort of living you deserve. Call 1-800-JAE-MAN or visit our website, jman.com.au.
Gildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Gildacare.
You're listening to Coach and the Doctor, thanks to Gildacare Support Coordinators, where it takes a village. Doctor, welcome along, Doctor.
Thank you, Coach. Doctor. Great to be here.
And Coach, not a real coach. Now, with us is a man... Well, let me just read some of his bio. His name is Joe Williams. He's a suicide prevention and wellbeing educator. Joe is a proud Wiradjuri Wagaloo, a First Nations Australian man, born in Cowra, raised in Wagga, New South Wales, Australia, and a former NRL player. Joe, there's a few things there that you and I have in common, but first of all, I want to talk rugby league.
Well, can I ask the first question? Yeah, because I don't really want to talk about the NRL. I'm going to say, Joe, who do you follow in the AFL, more importantly?
Oh, gee.
I follow the Swans. If I'm honest, I believe it's a better game.
Thank you. That's all I need to hear right now.
I think it's a game, and me being a Wiradjuri Wagaloo man, First Nation man, it's a game that was derived from one of our games. When we talk about mongrel, the game of what Australian rules is now is one of our original games. So I believe it's a game built for our people, like agile and fast and nimble. The game of rugby league, it's now becoming very much a bash and barge game with very strong, big athletes. I won't say that there's not big, strong athletes in the AFL. That's not what I'm saying at all, but I'm saying that the game is very much suited, and I think you'll see even more dominance over the next 10 years in the NRL of the Polynesian influence, because they're big and strong and fast and big athletes. There's not a lot of us mob that are like that, you know. So, you know, the AFL, as you over the years, look at Eddie Betts. Eddie Betts is only a tiny little fella, but he's short and he's nimble and he's fast and he's creative. And, you know, if I'm honest, my eldest boy plays AFL, doesn't play Luke.
I think that's great. So we don't have to talk about the NRL or the State of Origin. So let's just talk about the pure game.
Having said that, Joe, what sort of memories do you have playing rugby league in the NRL? There you go, Doctor. I've asked that question. Because we've got to get that out of the way. Well, look at some of the teams, the South Sydney, Penrith, and the Bulldogs as well. And then you ended up being a boxer. We'll get onto that in a minute.
You know, like I was a kid. I was just a kid like any kids that we know that grew up with dreams in his eyes to be a rugby league player. My dad played in the Winfield Cup. I grew up just wanting to be everything like my dad and everything like my big brother. My big brother didn't go on to those heights.
Can we just explain, Joe, what the Winfield Cup was?
The Winfield Cup was before when they used to go loud and proud with cigarette labelling and things like that. The Winfield Cup was what was the New South Wales rugby league before you know the Queensland national, influence and the New Zealand influence, and then making it a national game. So the old man played in the Winfield Cup and was taken in Sydney by an immortal of the game, a beautiful man that I was lucky enough to live with, and who actually signed me to the club with Arthur Beetson.
Great man.
And Beetso signed me as a 13-year-old kid. I grew up just wanting to be a rugby league player. That's all I wanted to do. I'd kick the footy, sleep with the footy, all that sort of stuff, you know, as a lot of young people did. I was lucky enough to go down and play a few games down at that level. So
they used to call Arthur Beetson half a game Artie, mate, because he was only fit enough to basically play half a game, but that half a game, he was absolutely devastating. One of the great ball players of the game of rugby league before people even knew what a ball player was. Am I correct in saying that, Joe?
Mate, what I will say is that, you know, I was fortunate enough to attend his. I guess there was a funeral there was a bigger funeral for people that could go, and then there was a smaller funeral. You know, I was lucky enough to attend that smaller funeral and with, you know, closer family and so forth. And it was the first time I'd ever seen footage of him play, and oh my God, was he a good player! Like I lived with the bloke for two years when I was living in Sydney, and I had a relationship with him pretty much all my life because he took Dad down to play there, and I lived at his house as a bloody 18-month-old, two and three-year-old when the old man was playing down in Sydney, so we had that relationship with him all my life, and then I'd never actually seen a great deal of footage. I seen some footage at his funeral, and it was like, wow, this guy was something else.
He was special. This is how old I am. In 1966, as a very, very young boy, my dad took me to the SCG because I'm from around where you grew up, and I watched him play in a World Cup. That's right, Rugby League had a World Cup. There's still not a lot of teams playing in it, but they had a World Cup. And he got sent off, but Jesus, I tell you what, he had a great game. Him and another French guy got sent off, and I can remember that vividly as a little boy, how good he was as a player. So, yes, he was a sensational player. Doctor's rolling his eyes. He doesn't want to talk about rugby league anymore.
I'm just a little bit bored at the moment about rugby league, that's all.
It is. See, that's the thing, Joe. If you don't talk Hawthorn, you can talk AFL, and he's reasonably interested, but it's got to be Hawthorn. That's it. Nothing else.
Let's do the life story of Jason Dunstall.
Mate, where do you want to start? So I first remember watching Jason when he came down from Queensland.
Righto.
No, we won't go into that. I do want to ask some questions pertinent to what we're talking about here and Joe's life post-rugby league and boxing. And kind of just want to talk to you about your bipolar disorder. When was that first diagnosed?
Back in 2010.
So pretty much up until then. So how old were you there?
What are we, 12 years ago?
Okay, so you're an adult, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I was an adult. Yeah. So
it was post NRL, post boxing.
Post rugby league career is during my boxing career. It was actually on the back of a marriage breakdown. One of the things that come out of that, I guess the wash up out of that marriage breakdown is that my ex wife said, "Joe, I think you've got bipolar." I just thought it was, you know, like, not many marriages end amicably, right? Yeah. So I just thought it was I thought it was a pot shot because and the times and the understandings or the lack of understanding around what it was, and then when I was diagnosed and I started to look more into it and understand more about bipolar disorder. And I'm like, I was asked the question, what was it like when you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder? I was like, well, it made sense because of the erraticness of my life. Some of the behaviours that I was showing around different things. So it made sense.
Was it a relief in some respects?
The time frame of it, right? I still thought something was wrong with me, okay? Because of the, you know, if we think there's stigma about mental illness now, think about what it was like in 2010.
Yeah.
You know, 12 years ago, only in the clinic's chair was it spoken about. It made sense to me. It was a relief. It was like, wow, actually, I know what it's like. I know what this is now. I guess the journey of it, being medicated and I would say wrongly medicated and then over-medicated and under-medicated, and the journey of finding what works till I was actually based in the US doing a lot of work in the US and out here, sort of month on, month off sort of thing. And I saw a psych in the US and then I was put on a mood stabilizer, and I was like, wow, this is what it's like to be like level. But then the journey of that, I went into, and I haven't told this story often, I went to a funeral and I couldn't cry. I was upset, but the tears just wouldn't come out, and I couldn't understand what was going on with that. And I said to myself, and I'm someone who's a very self-aware person, particularly when I got sober and clean from alcohol and drugs. You know when you're up and you know when you're down, right? It's about finding out when you're up and when you're down, or why you're up and why you're down, right? So I said to myself, I've just lost someone extremely close to me in my life and my family, and I can't even grieve. I can't cry. And obviously I think that was because of the mood stabilizer that was stopping me from going so low or stopping me from going so high. And then that's when I actually said to my partner, I said, because I finished the medication that I was on, and I'd actually spoke to another doctor about getting on some new stuff, but he said, I want to take you onto another medication, but we need to take you off the one that you're on now, right? So we need to titrate you down. And then when I got completely down, I said, I want to stay off it, and I made a promise to my partner. I said, if I get too down and my behaviours are beyond my control, as far as my erraticness, my highs and my lows, if my behaviours are beyond my control, because as we know with people with bipolar disorder, we don't know that we're impacting other people until we're deep in it. I said, I need you to make a promise to me, and if I need to go back to the clinic, I need to go back to the clinic. If I need to go back to the hospital, I need to go back to the hospital. I'm going to promise you I'll trust you, but I need you to promise me that you'll call me out on these behaviours. And that was close to 7 years ago now, and I haven't been medicated since.
So you're not on any medication for...
Not a bit, no. No medication at all. Again, someone who's super, super duper self-aware. So I still have the highs and the lows, without doubt. I still have those. It's just that I have different cultural practices now for me that keep me leveled, especially when I'm high, and a life as an ex-athlete, a commitment to more exercise when I'm low.
So can you describe some of those moments out of...
Which one? Which one's the highs or the lows?
Yeah, well, both, either, whatever. Can you remember some of those moments that have stuck out in your mind as somewhere you don't want to go again?
Well, this is the thing, right, is that... Those highs and lows still happen. It's not as if I stopped taking medication and my bipolar went away. I've still very much got the behaviours of bipolar disorder. I just know how to manage it better now.
Right.
And I've got the people around me to call me out on the behaviours when I'm high.
So if somebody does call you out on it, what's typically your reaction to that? Is your automatic reaction to go, I'm fine, or do you sit back and go, okay, I need to kind of analyze the last week, the last 2 weeks, last month?
It's always our first response, isn't it? It's always like, I'm all right, I know what I'm doing, leave me alone. That's a lot of people's first response. The
Absolutely.
Initial thought process that goes in their mind, right? For me, it's more like particularly when I'm manic, I'm a spender. I went to the shop this morning, actually. I went to the shop, and you don't realise until you've done it. I went to the shop this morning, and I only went there for a loaf of bread. But I got a loaf of bread, and I got some crumpets, and I got some cereal, and then I got out of the shop, and I went, I haven't got some butter. So I went around the servo to get some butter. Like, my mind just goes a million miles an hour, and then I get out of it, and I go, I didn't need this stuff. Here's an example of mania. I come home from a trip from the US, right, doing some work in the US, and I was paid quite a substantial lump sum of money. I spent $15,000 a week.
On
clothes. I bought like six suits. Like, there's only one of me.
Like, you like suits, obviously.
I can only wear one. Like, and it was just stuff. I just went, I don't need any of this stuff. What am I doing? The other side of the scale is that when I'm super duper low, I'm a terrible person to be around. I don't want to get out of bed. I'm snappy, and that's not a good job for someone who's should be out in the world trying to motivate and potentially help people. You know, so it's about the management. Like, if I eat rubbish and don't exercise continuously for a month, there's every chance I'll slip down a hole of depression.
When you are in those moments, so you've bought the six suits and you go, Joe, you're a dickhead. Why did you buy six suits? Do you beat yourself up on that, or do you just go, okay, I realise what I've done, I need to fix that and just move forward? And then the other part of the question is, when you're low and you're in bed, not wanting to get up, how do you get yourself up?
I've got to convince the boss first. I've got to tell her that I just spent $10,000 on suits, which never goes down well.
No.
but it's like I come home from the shop this morning, you know, and the same sort of thing. And it's those moments of, as soon as you know that you're up, that's when you can start to pull yourself down or do the behaviours that you need to do to pull yourself back down, like your meditations and stuff like that, right?
Right.
So what I do is I do my best to let it go. I do my best to accept it. I'm also a believer, right, of that for us culturally, we believe that everything happens the way it's supposed to happen on the day that it's supposed to happen at exactly the time it's supposed to happen, right? So if I go out and buy 10 suits, for 100,000 years, every day was leading to me buying those 10 suits. What I do next is most important, right? So I can't control what I'd done. Or I can't change what I'd done because I was always going to do it forever.
You're predestined to do it.
Yeah, I believe that I was predestined to do certain things, right? It's a hard thing to do. It's a tough pill to swallow at times. So for me, acceptance has been my biggest thing. And again, going back to the moments of the initial times of bipolar disorder and when going through my biggest moments of recovery and discovery is that acceptance has been the biggest thing. I may have these behaviours for the absolute rest of my life. I've got to accept that they may be there forever because a lot of people get in trouble when they go, oh, shit, I didn't think that I'd get to this point again. I hear it all the time. I've beaten depression. I've beaten my anxiety. And then I'm cradling that person a month later because they're back down to exactly where they were. For me, it's about management of different things, different behaviours in how I respond to things. The different physical behaviours on reaction of my first response in my brain.
Joe, we'll take a quick break, mate. It's fantastic chat, great conversation here on Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to J-Man Active. If the body is active, the mind will follow. Have to get those plugs in, Joe. You're more than aware that sort of thing's got to happen. We'll talk a little bit more about your bipolar, also a bit more about your culture. I'm really, really interested to hear that. Also, you have you mentioned off-air to our producer, Amy, you can do something else, which I think is pretty cool. The doctor doesn't know what it is, so we won't tell him just yet. And also just talk about your upbringing and coming from the mighty town of Cowra, which I know very, very well. That's after this break here on Coach and the Doctor.
J-Man inspires and supports NDIS participants to live their best lives.
We do tap dancing together, which is a lot of fun. She's just so understanding of mental illness, and I feel like I can tell her anything and that she won't judge me.
Now is the time to get J-Man active.
Increase my self-esteem and self-worth, and has just made me feel so much better about myself.
jman.com.au. That's jaeman.com.au.
Gildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Gildacare.
This is Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to support coordinators Gildacare, who specialise in, amongst many things, psychosocial recovery coaching. Coach here, not a real coach. Doctor, not a real doctor. And Joe Williams, well, he's a real suicide prevention and wellbeing educator, which is just one of the many things that he does. Now, Joe, you mentioned to Amy earlier, our producer, that you have a talent, so we've got to be very careful what we say around you, even if we turn the microphones off. Can you let us know what that is?
It's funny, you know, because I've caught so many people talking smack about me because I can read lips.
There you go.
It was a thing, you know, like my sister growing up, she was, I think it was like 75 to 80% deaf. So she had to have, you know, that were quite big and quite visible hearing aids, and they didn't actually pick it up for so long because she could read lips. And my sister's super duper smart, right? So in school, that's why she was a really, really clever kid, really, really smart, intelligent student who was just so smart because she could just process everything that came out of the teacher's mouth because she could read the lips.
And so where did you learn to read lips?
Just sitting around with each other. We all did it.
Did you have like competitions to see who could do it the best?
Of course we did.
Yeah.
Like it's one of those things, you know, like a family rivalry. People don't believe me, and I'm so, oh, that's fine. I don't care if you don't believe me or you don't. And again,
I'm going to test him.
when we're talking about reading lips, right, is that I can pick up 2 or 3 out of 10 words.
Yes.
And then, you know, we all know how clever the brain is that when we can start to then piece it together.
Yeah.
So when off air, when your producer started talking to me, I come through to me. Hey Joe, how you doing? Is everything all right? And you know, can you hear me okay? And all that sort of stuff. I said, I know what you said, but no, I can't hear you because you're on mute. And it sort of blew her out a little bit. The fact that I'd pretty much recited everything back to her, but she was on mute. So
Joe, we'll talk in a minute about what you're doing now, but I just want to touch on your culture. You're a First Nations Aboriginal man, born in Cowra and raised in Wagga. Is that right?
Born in Cowra, born in Cowra. Lived there till I was 10, and then the old man being a footy player. We all know what it's like out in the bush playing footy, going to different towns and communities and so forth like that to play. To get courted by different teams and stuff like that. So we ended up down in Wagga, yeah.
What are the memories of growing up in Wagga? And I noticed you said Wagga, not Wagga Wagga. People who don't know the area call it Wagga Wagga. People who live there say Wagga.
You say that every time.
That's the truth. Well, am I right, Joe? I'm right. Joe knows.
It's either that or we're just lazy. Just don't say the full word.
But
or,
you must have.
Actually, it was a bit of a running joke. And I actually don't know if this is true or not, and I shouldn't say that it's actually a joke, but it was a running conversation for years when we first lived there. We thought that the people who named Wagga and the surrounding towns must have had a stutter because there's Wagga Wagga, Gumley Gumley, and Book Book, which are all towns within 45 minutes of Wagga. So that was the running commentary. And again, this is, I understand that it's not a joke. And, you know, this is something that was conversed with 25 years ago. So
maybe I grew up in Forbes. Maybe it's Forbes. I don't know.
Maybe in Forbes. Actually, the old man, people always say the old man played in the Winfield Cup out of Cowra. He actually played the Winfield Cup out of Forbes.
Oh, don't say that.
Group 11. Group 11.
He played a Group 11. The year he made country from Group 11. And then went down. Artie Beetson took you down after a year after that.
He would have played with Peter Kennedy.
He played with PK, yeah.
Great player.
Great man.
Better player than Mick Cronin, I reckon. But anyway,
I'm still in the room, by the way.
The doctor's got a question for you. We can talk about this for ages.
Yeah, no, we're trying to do one whole show without the coach bringing up Forbes. And, Joe, you just let us down.
You just let us down.
We got so far without mentioning Forbes.
Oh, it's beautiful.
That's what they call them, don't they? Swampies?
Magpies. Magpies, we call the Forbes Rugby League team. I was a ball.
Yeah, but the town's based in it was built in a swamp.
No, but next to the Lachlan River, the greatest river in New South Wales.
I understand where it's built and where it's born, but it was built and settled on a swamp.
Oh, I'm sorry, Joe, you've never lived there, mate, so you're not qualified to say that, mate. Okay.
As I said previously, I'm still here as well.
Right, so you'll want me to cut all this out.
Yeah. Joe, I want to talk to you about the work you're doing now with the workshops in dealing for people with adversity, struggles, addiction, connection and that sort of stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about that sort of work and what you do and maybe a little bit about how you do it?
You know, like, it started back in 2014 on the back of, I guess, being public about the struggles that I've been through. And what a lot of people don't understand is that even throughout my sports career and a long time as well, is that I've lived with suicidal ideation since I was a 13-year-old kid. And that little voice inside your head that tells you you're not good enough and that you'd never amount to anything and that it planted thoughts, plans and ideas of not being here anymore every single day since that day. I guess what I come up with over many years was ways to deal with those challenges and adversities. And when it finally came to the surface, and again, back in 2014, so it wasn't a hot topic back then. It was literally the short film was launched a week out from my second WBF world title fight. So it was like, wow, this guy's just about to fight for a massive title, massive fight in Wagga, and he's been going through this depression and suicidal ideation all his life, but he's still gotten through these, I guess, these achievements in his sporting career. So what it did was obviously raised a hell of a lot of topic, a big conversation in the community then, but also what happened out of that was a stack load of people started coming up to me saying, Joe, what you're speaking about, what it is what you're going through, I actually go through the same thing. You've just put a voice or a label to exactly the experiences that I have. And the more people that come up to me like that, the more I thought to myself, you know, like, this is a conversation that's got to get louder. It's a conversation that needs to be had it's a conversation that was always had in the dark, you know. So it's a conversation that needs to be brought out, and it's a conversation that's real, because there's so many of these people talking about it. There's so many of these people who are experiencing exactly what I'm experiencing, and they don't feel that they can talk about it, you know. So I guess on the back of being someone who was profiled during a sports career, then going into schools and having these conversations that feelings are actually okay to talk about, it just sort of blew up from there. And where it got from there to obviously talking about my experiences with diagnosed mental illness, my experiences with suicide attempts, and my experiences with mental health ward stays, talking, I guess in the early days it was like I was the conduit between the people and the professional. It was like, this guy speaks about it, and he goes and sees someone to speak about it, maybe I should too, sort of thing. So it was like the conversations I was having in schools with kids was, you've got a school counsellor here. Let's go and start to talk about how we feel. To then, I guess we, you know, like, things develop over time. I was the keynote at the World Indigenous Suicide Prevention Conference in 2016 over in New Zealand, Aotearoa. And the buzz around the room there was different. This was First Nation, Indigenous, Native peoples from around the world. And if you look at it, we've all got challenges with mental health. We've all got challenges with suicide. We've all got challenges with addictions. We've all got challenges with removal of cultural and practices. We've all got challenges of residential schools and being removed away from stolen generations and things like that. And the buzz around the room was very different. The buzz around the room was, our people aren't dying from mental health. That's what it looks like. Our people are dying from the products of a change of lifestyle that's been impacted by colonisation. And the ongoing development of what I then started to speak about was, if our people aren't dying by mental health, then we're dying from the impacts of trauma. So the work that I do now is more particularly based around trauma and how we behave and why we behave that way. So a lot of the work that I do now is all around why we behave the way we do, why the person's the loudest in the room, why the person is the joker, why the person is really secluded and doesn't like to talk about things, why the person gets triggered by certain music, why the person gets triggered by certain perfumes, you know? So it's about helping people to understand what their reactions are and why their brain goes into a certain state, you know, throughout our lifestyle, which is this thing called trauma.
I suppose you're minimizing trauma or trying to explain trauma?
Well, it's helping people to explain what it is.
Yeah.
Helping people to understand what it is. And we all are on different parts along the path. People don't understand the actual concept, you know, or a lot of people think that trauma is physical things, emotional things, sexual things that happen to us in our lives. The big things, you know, the big capital T traumas and the, you know, the big heartaches and the big loss in our lives. Without understanding, it's the little tiny changes in chemistry in our brain that impacts our physiology and changes the way that our DNA is transcribed.
It's almost like the straw that broke the camel's back, is what you're saying. It's like it's all these little things that eventually build up to cause maybe a major trauma. Would that be right?
Because those major traumas are just bigger traumas on top of bigger traumas.
Right. So there's all these smaller triggers.
It's all of these smaller things that happen throughout our lives, like letting our kids cry themselves to sleep. It's like a baby crying that they're hungry and a mother or a father saying, oh, they've had enough. When this little baby who can't articulate what it's actually trying to say is in the most distress that it can be in because it's absolutely screaming for its life. And we've got parents that close the door on these kids and go, oh, they'll soothe themselves and fall. They're just overtired. They'll fall asleep. Right, so that's the depth of work that I go into.
Wow,
the stuff that the last keynote that I did at an international Indigenous conference was how childhood adversity and trauma impacts our behaviours as adults. So we're looking at why. So you know, you've all heard of the fight or flight response.
Yep.
You know why people are so hypervigilant in times around their fight or flight, or why it's overreactive, is the things that have happened in the very, very early years in their life. What a lot of people don't understand is that everything is formed in the first 3 to 5 years in our life.
And I hear, and I believe there's a connection between trauma at an early age and bipolar.
Yeah. There is, and depression and anxiety.
Yep.
Like it's again, like when I talk about everything's formed in those early years, it's all formed because of the chemistry of our brain in dealing with adversity, the adverse situations, the adverse challenges that we have in life. There's a fantastic podcast where I think she's the Surgeon General of California, Dr. Nadine Burke Harris. She talks about the fight or flight response of when you're standing there and you're ready to, there's a bear in the woods and and this bear comes out of nowhere and is standing directly in front of you and the different reactions that happen into our brain and our pulse and our, you know, our heart rate and the cortisol release in our brain. And we're standing there ready to fight the bear or run from the bear. And she goes, it's fantastic if there's a bear, but what if there's not a bear? And it's these little adverse situations that happen in the household every single night, yeah, with alcohol abuse, with violence, with, again, like the loud response of things that scares a young child. You know, all of these response mechanisms are actually built into our brain as a form of survival, but they've actually been turned on and off too many times and actually become maladaptive and then forming things like anxiety.
Joe, on a personal level, do you obviously implement the skills you've learned over the years with your own family?
Yeah. I've got teenagers. I've got teenagers, and we know how challenging teenagers can be. What it comes down to, and I shared a great post on social media this morning, and it's all about emotions, right? We all have these emotions, and the thing that I shared on social media is that if you're getting angry or frustrated that your child is always upset and crying, we need to talk about your emotional regulation, not your child's emotional regulation, because children are just these little beings that struggle to articulate how they feel, particularly the ones who can't talk, right? And we're, as adults, we're supposed to be the ones who are the, you know, the more sound and responsible in how we behave. We're getting angry because we are triggered by these little kids that are crying, when all the kid's trying to do is tell us something. They just don't have the language to be able to do it.
With all of the talks and whatnot that you do and the workshops and all of that, have you found that it's actually helped you?
The amount of growth that I've done in the last 4 years is, 3 to 4 years has been, it's just been eye-opening to the, like, it's like the lights have turned on. So now I'm aware of what's happening. One thing, and people say that the pandemic was super challenging, and I get and I respect that it was for a lot of people. But for me, the pandemic is the absolute best thing that ever happened to me personally, right? Let me explain why. Is that I went from going to being on the road, you know, 300 plus days in a year in 100 odd communities around the country every year, to then stopping and being at home, like everyone else. And the one thing I realized in all of that is that I've been a dad for 18 years. Sorry, I've been a father for 18 years, but a dad for 2. That's one of the most confronting things I've ever, ever, ever had a self-realization of, because whilst I was a father, I was never at home. When I was playing in the NRL, I was training and playing for 5 or 6 days a week. And when I was home, I was resting and recovering. But in the early days is when I was struggling with alcohol and drugs. And then I get sober and start to feel all these feelings. And then I have that marriage separation. And then I re-partner and have another child. And then I'd separate for that partner and child again. So I was never around in the early days for that child. I go into the work that I do now, had 2 more children. And I'm living overseas. And whilst my partner's at home, you know, with the kids. And I'm like, I've never been at home with my kids. And now that things are starting to get back on the road again, I don't want to go. Because whilst I love the work that I do, and I love interacting and connecting with people out there in community, because there's, and let's call it what it is, a stack load of people who are just struggling in pain, mental and emotional pain, I've got a responsibility to be at home and develop secure a relationship and attachments with my babies at home. Otherwise, again, if we understand secure attachment, otherwise that's just going to play out in their behaviours and relationships later in their life.
And so how do you balance that now?
We've been doing it online for 2 years. So the first thing I do is offer a session online when I can. But my manager's fantastic in the way that she manages things, because she knows that if I go flat stick for 2 weeks, I need a week at home, because I just sat back and I go, I don't know how we did it, because of being away so long and being so fast. And when I look back, I was probably manic the whole time.
Yeah.
when I was doing it. So it's about management, and we're working on a few different things to keep me settled in the one space, which is really, really, really exciting, which is great, which when we talk about, I guess, legacy, what we're working on at the moment as a company is hopefully will play out for many years after I'm gone.
Well, Joe, we could talk for a lot longer than we already have, and we've probably gone over and used up more than enough of your time, so I'm sorry about that, but I'd love to have you back maybe in 6 months' time.
We need a point two.
Yeah, we do. And just to see how that is, you know, once the COVID has settled down to a certain extent, and see whether or not you do stay at home as much as you'd like, and I hope you do, and I'm sure you hope you do as well. But, mate, it's been fantastic. We didn't cover as many things as I would have liked, but whilst we're here, we'd like you to be able to tell us how people can contact you or what they can read about you and where to go.
This is your free plug.
The best way to get hold of me is through my website, which is just joewilliams.com.au. As a guy who got knocked around the head a hell of a lot during his rugby league and boxing career, boxing more so, I need to keep it nice and simple. So joewilliams.com.au.
I can remember that.
And just on all my social media platforms as well, which is fairly easy to find. So a lot of what I do is just helping people to understand who they are and why they are, and just trying to create conversations with that person to be able to look deeper into themselves and to go through these processes of healing. Another great quote I saw this morning is that we don't necessarily have troubled teenagers. We have a hell of a lot of unhealed parents. So what we need to do as parents, start to do the work as to who we are and why we are, and give our young people a break.
That's very profound.
It is.
It's something that I think a lot of people will take to the bank, really, when you think about it. Joe Williams, thanks so much for your time, mate. It's been a great chat. And as we said, we'd love to have you back at some other stage if you can squeeze us in amongst all your business and also your family activities as well. Thanks for your time, mate.
Let's work it out. I'll get back in here and we'll do it again.
Great stuff. Thanks, Joe.
Gildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Gildacare.
Hi, Coach here from J-Man. Back again with another season of the J-Pod, a podcast that is about living with and experiencing mental illness and physical disability.
Haven't had a relationship for 20 years since I broke up with my wife because I don't feel like I would burden anybody with me because of my condition. It all gets back to that sense of being a lesser.
The J-Pod, brought to you by J-Man Active. If the body is active, the mind will follow. jman.com.au.
When your message is timely, trustworthy and delivered in a positive environment, it's powerful. That's why sponsors of 89.9 The Light see great results. Visit thelight.com.au.
You're listening to Coach and the Doctor, thanks to support coordinators Gildacare, who specialise in, amongst many things, psychosocial recovery coaching. I'm Coach, not a real coach. Doctor is with me, not a real doctor. We've already done that in the intro, but I thought I'd just say that again. Welcome along. We've got a professor with us, Doctor, so that sort of outranks us.
I'm getting used to that now. So I used to be the highest ranking officer, but whenever there's a professor...
Right.
I get outranked. So
let's give him the big introduction. I did have a drum roll here somewhere, but I'm not quite sure if I know exactly where it is. But it's Professor Lars Ittner. He's the director of the Dementia Research Center and professor in the Department of Biomedical Sciences of the Faculty of Medicine, Health and Human Sciences at Macquarie University. So in other words, he's a pretty smart bloke.
With a very large business card.
Lars, welcome to Coach and the Doctor.
Thanks for having me. I'm not sure my business card is that big.
I can tell you a quick story about a business card, Lars, and from someone over in that neck of the woods, because Lars is from Europe, as you can probably tell a little bit later on. We'll talk about that, where he's actually from. But I don't know if you remember the racing car driver, Niki Lauda, a very famous driver. He was around for a long time, won a couple of world championships, got burnt very badly, came back really quickly. Anyway, a guy I knew was at a party one time and said he met Niki Lauda and said, "Oh, do you have a business card?" And Niki said, "Yeah, sure." And he gave him the business card, a white business card with the name Niki Lauda on it and nothing else.
Cool.
So you know you're big when you can do that. I think I might start doing that, Doctor. Anyway,
you're
enough about
big.
Me, enough about Niki. Lars, first of all, I mentioned earlier about your history as to where you're from. Can you give us a little bit of an idea how you ended up in Australia from Europe?
Yeah, look, originally I come from Germany and was raised in Switzerland and Germany and trained as a medical doctor again in Germany and in Switzerland. And in 2004, I believe it was end of 2004, one of my collaborators decided that he's going to move on into a higher position. And I really enjoyed working with him. So I asked him, "Hey, can you take me with you?" And he said, "Yeah, but I'm not sure where I'm going. Might be in the States, might be to East Germany. Oh, there's this remote off chance we're going to Sydney. I was praying for half a year he's going to Australia. And then, yeah, one day he told me that he's going to Australia, and I applied for fellowship and thought I'm going to spend about 2 years with him and, you know, gain some experience overseas. And then life happens and I'm still here.
So then you ditched him and you kept going.
I never ditched him. He's a really good friend of mine. And he went actually to Brisbane to head one of the most, you know, famous research centers in Australia. And yeah, I moved around in Sydney, never made it out of town. And
you're still here.
What about your family back in Germany? What did they think about you pulling up stumps and just deciding to move halfway around the world?
So first, you know, not so happy family story. It's not a big family anyway to start with. And my father always encouraged us to move around the world. He's a scientist and medical doctor himself. My brother is in Adelaide running a research center there. We worked for many years together here in Sydney, and he's now on his own two legs.
Wow. So the whole family's here now.
Yeah. And my sister is, you know, she's the only one who studied something decent. She studied art.
Well, I think you've studied something
and she's
decent.
And she's the wealthy one.
Yeah. Lars, dementia research is obviously a really, you know, an important research piece that you're working on. I've been touched by dementia with my mother. Can you, in layman's terms, explain the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's?
Dementia is really an umbrella term for any form of compromised cognitive performance that progresses, so progressive decline in cognitive performance. And Alzheimer's disease is a very specific disease under this umbrella term, so which has a very specific change in the brain, which is the deposition of two proteins. And I guess everyone has heard about the tangles and the plaques. And those characterize Alzheimer's disease. So if those are not present, you don't have Alzheimer's disease.
But you still have dementia.
You still can present with many other forms of dementias.
So what are the other forms of dementia?
Oh, there's a long list, and it might be longer than this show.
But, okay.
So I guess the important ones are the frontotemporal dementias, which different from what people think. They don't present initially with cognitive decline, but with language difficulties or even like aggressive behavior, disinhibition, these type of behaviors initially before they progress to the cognitive symptoms. And then there are other diseases which are associated with cognitive decline, like vascular dementia or even Parkinson's disease.
Well, there's something in your bio that really, really stood out for me, because my mum died of motor neuron. And so I suppose both the doctor and myself have some skin in the game as far as this conversation goes, because they're two of the topics that you work on. But it says here that gene treatments, like you've made major contributions to the understanding of Alzheimer's disease and dementia and identified several novel targets for drug development in these diseases. It says it may be possible after research that you've been doing at Macquarie University that these diseases, in some cases, even allow the return of some functions. Yeah. So you're actually at the point now where you can actually repair somebody?
Yeah, let's specify that. So our research has identified indeed several targets that you could target in at least the model systems to change the progression or even halt the progression of the symptoms. And there was one particular change that we targeted, something that I'm very proud of, because we discovered it. It was my brother and myself who discovered that together. And so we developed and devised a gene therapy approach, which we then tested in a wide range of model systems, how it affects the cognitive decline. And we really expected it in the best case to stop the progress. And it stopped the progress of neurodegeneration, so loss of neurons. But what we also found is that, and you typically use animal models for this type of studies, and because you can test cognition in them, which you can't test in the cell culture. You can test a lot of things in the cell culture, and we do that, but some things you have to use the animal model. And in these animal models, which are modified such that they develop Alzheimer's disease, we could not only stop their progression of deficits, but when we started treating very old mice, which are very far down the symptomatic line already, so they can't really learn new tasks. We could reinstate their ability to learn. So what we can't repair, obviously, is a lost neuron. What's lost is unfortunately lost. And there are some researchers working on ways to introduce newborn neurons into the brain, but all those that will not be filled with memory. So the memory that we've lost, we've probably lost forever. But in the daily living, it makes a huge difference if you can learn or not. So if you can learn again and say, I have to refill the fridge at the end of the week, so I have food next week. That's very important. Mm. Or, I have to change my clothes regularly. And look after hygiene. So if you can relearn these abilities, that will improve the life of people also that have lost memories, might have lost the name of the loved one, but if they can relearn them, that in my understanding is a big change.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so if I hear you correctly, what you're saying is the memories that are lost are gone. However, if my mother forgot my name, she can be retaught my name. Would that be right?
Well, that would be a very simple task to learn, for instance. Yeah.
Right.
Can this be adapted to make people smarter?
That's a big dream, right?
you've got no hope, right?
I have no experimental evidence for it, because we actually treat control groups of mice that are completely normal to start with, and they haven't become smarter. Yeah. I'm sorry to disappoint.
No, don't worry about it.
Because I'm having trouble at the moment working out a computer issue that I should be able to deal with, but I've got to get our computer guy to do it, and I'm thinking, why can't I remember how to do it?
So I just want to take a step back. How do you lose these neurons? Like, what happens? And is there any way, because obviously prevention is better than cure. What you're suggesting in the cure, fantastic, but I'm guessing that'll make your job even easier if we can prevent it up front.
I'm all with you. I think the ultimate goal is to prevent it all the way. So to answer your first question, that is how these neurons die, is ultimately we don't understand. We have a very detailed understanding of processes that contribute to this. But ultimately, in every individual, and what makes every individual neuron to die, we don't understand. But having said that, we have understood a lot of pathways that contribute to that. And that, for instance, could be the deposition of proteins. So you could imagine if a neuron is not an empty space, it's packed with proteins, and they all have their roles, and they have to be able to move around. And if you introduce now a tangle, so which is literally a deposition, like a tangle in your hair that fills up the space, you could imagine that already the pure presence of such a tangle impairs the normal movement of proteins within such a cell. And then it goes beyond that obviously has toxic effects in itself. So then it becomes very complex. The second question was, can we prevent this from doing? And again, the answer is we don't understand enough about how it starts that we can target to prevent. But what we can for sure say is that it's almost like a muscle. When we don't go to the gym and train your muscle, or you don't lift anything, just lie in the bed, watch TV all day,
coach,
you will lose your muscle. And the same is with the brain. Keep training it. And there is, in fact, very interesting research coming out of the Viking in Tasmania, where they voluntarily enabled elderly to return to university. And they compared them and tracked them over time. And over time, as the years passed, they could really distinguish these two groups, those who decided to do their retirement and do whatever they like, and those who say, well, I'm going to take a few lessons at the university. They do cognitively better in the daily cognitive tasks. So the key thing is continued education.
Anecdotally, people say, oh, you should keep doing puzzles and Sudoku and all these sort of things to keep your mind busy. So that's pretty spot on from what you're saying.
Absolutely. And do music, learn an instrument, continue to improve your skills on an instrument. Physical activity, there's a bit of controversial evidence there. There's some big studies say it's actually not so good for the brain. But then I would argue, well, if your brain is good, but the rest of your body has problems, then it's also not good. So I think maintaining physical health, healthy lifestyle in general is beneficial.
Healthy body, healthy mind. So when my mother was diagnosed with dementia, of course, I turned it round to make it about me. And by saying that, I went to Dementia Australia and I said, look, is it hereditary? Do I need to do anything now? I mean, because mum's got it, does that mean I'm going to get it or one of my siblings is going to get it? And they said no. Is that still the case?
Again, the answer is a bit more complicated than no. So there are the forms of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia which are for sure inherited because people carry a mutation in their genome. So they will pass that on, and if you carry that, you will get the disease. Then there's a second, much larger proportion where there are changes in the genome. They're called risk genes. So they're not for sure you get it, but they increase your risk of getting that. So if you combine a few of those, plus you have an unhealthy lifestyle, you might end up with dementia. And then there are those who show an inherited pattern, but we really don't understand why. And then there's a much larger proportion which is just not inherited.
Well, my grandmother died of dementia and my mother died of motor neurons, so my odds aren't looking too good.
Not with your lifestyle.
I hear that story very often that I tell people there's, you know, the inherited proportion is relatively small, but then everyone says, oh, my grandmother had, my grandfather, my father. So it's too often that pattern to not have it.
It's an interesting subject, and it's a subject, especially motor neuron, I had no idea about until my mother actually contracted it. And bizarrely, last, she was a theatre sister, a registered nurse. She's the one that actually diagnosed herself because the doctors did not want to diagnose her with motor neuron. It took her a year to convince them that she had motor neuron.
Is that a question?
No, I'm doing what you normally do, and it's a statement, and I'm waiting for Lars's reaction, but people can't see him. He's there puffing away going, what's this bloke going on about? I can tell that.
That's not my thought. My thought is that's actually a very sad story.
Yeah.
This is where education, not only of the public, but also of the practitioners, is absolutely required.
Great statement, great answer I got. Fantastic. On that note, I'm in control here, Lars. So you're listening to Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to JulderCare, who are support coordinators, and they do, amongst many things, psychosocial recovery coaching. Lars, after the break, I want to have a chat to you about pink clusters, which I find very, very interesting.
I'm looking forward to that chat, along with the connection between motor neuron, dementia, and epilepsy.
Epilepsy. After this break, here on Coach and the Doctor.
Are you or someone you know in need of a compassionate support coordinator? JulderCare is your team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. We'll make the NDIS process easy for you and your loved ones to navigate. We'll coordinate all your care and support, specialist support and, if required, psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, JulderCare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Visit us at jildacare.com.au.
J-Man inspires and supports NDIS participants to live their best lives and promotes experiences for people with a disability. The NDIS can be confusing, so if you're thinking about applying for funding or not sure how your plan actually works, J-Man can help and guide you through every step of the process at no cost to you. jaeman.com.au. That's jaeman.com.au. Now is the time to get the most out of your NDIS. Call us for a free consultation. 1-800-JAEMAN.
When you become a sponsor of 89.9 The Light, your business is immediately part of something bigger. Our sponsors help us make a positive difference within the community in many different ways. Every dollar you invest on growing your business goes on to be a dollar invested in Melbourne. Visit the sponsorship page at thelight.com.au and get in touch. Find out more about being part of something bigger and giving back. 89.9 The Light. Positive radio, positive impact.
This is Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to J-Man Active. Visit jaeman.com.au for all the latest activities. With us is Professor Lars Ittner, who is a real professor, as opposed to doctor not being a real doctor and coach not being a real coach. I mentioned before the break, I wanted to talk to you about the brain's pink clusters and some research that yourself and your wife have been doing or had been doing during lockdown. Can you explain, Lars?
Just before you explain that, Lars, I was going to start by saying, what did you do during lockdown?
Me?
Because Lars has been very busy, was very busy.
I was never locked down. You know that, Doctor.
But, no, I envy you.
They couldn't stop me. Yeah, what was that all about, Lars? What did you do during lockdown?
Oh, I did primarily homeschooling. Like everyone else who has kids during this time, and it was life just really tough.
So he's not a real professor. He's a homeschool professor.
Oh, right.
He's one of those.
So you got it from Kmart.
I can tell you, I found my limitations. I'm for sure not a good primary school teacher. During that lockdown, primarily the first lockdown, we had, like, I guess like everyone, we rethought what we are doing. Like, rethought what you do with life, what you want, where you want to go. And so got a lot of time to think about where we want to go with our research. And one of the things that we faced over the years is, let's put it this way. I think everyone hits a ceiling in their research life. And then is your question, do you, and that can be very high, right? Could be very successful and you're going to hover there and you can live out your whole research life there. But for me, change was always a part of my research career. And when I hit a ceiling, I get bored very easily. So I wanted to break through that ceiling, do something new. And so one thing that we always face is the question, how relevant are our models? Because we do a lot in rodent models. So we explored possibilities to complement our work with more human relevant models, but still have the 3D structure of a brain. So we developed or introduced this technology called brain organoids, which are three-dimensional cell clusters that self-organize in something like a brain. And that's from human stem cells. And this is a technology we basically brought all the knowledge together during the lockdown. We recruited some people. And then once the lab gates opened again, we kicked this off and started this line of work. And within a year, built up this new capacity.
You found that stem cell technology had progressed to a point where you could potentially use it to create miniature brains. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that's exactly what we're doing now. So when I say progress, so my original training in research was actually in stem cell work and brain development before I switched to the dementia field. And back then, variability was a huge problem. So when you try to program them in a way that would sometimes go down the fate that you wanted, sometimes not. But others have over the last 15 years made amazing discoveries around this development. So the technology we found was now at the stage where we could apply it to our research, where it's reproducible and produces these round mini brain-like structures, which have neuronal connection. These neurons fire like in a normal brain, and you can introduce mutations there, introduce plugs and tangles and these things.
That's incredible.
Would you be able to put it into the coach's skull, a little miniature brain? Because that'd really help him.
Yeah, I probably line up first for that.
Does that actually mean potentially brain transplants?
No. Again, yes, you could probably transplant. If I take your stem cell, I could eventually transplant it into you. But the problem is they have no knowledge. Mm. It's like dead weight. So I don't think that's the way to treat the disease, but it's the way to understand
it, yeah. So does brain size have anything to do with intelligence?
Doubt it, to be honest. I think it's training, knowledge, education. There's probably some inherited component to it. I doubt it.
Because I know that whales don't have a large brain, but they're rather intelligent animals.
Yeah, and some birds have, you always say it's a bird brain, but then, some birds are quite smart. So
Lars, what sparked your interest in neurodegenerative diseases in the brain?
I worked too long on the development of the brain, and then I'm a trained doctor, and I really wanted to make a difference. And so I got more interested in the longevity of the brain and what fails when diseases strike. And at the moment, yeah, I'm reinventing myself and working much more on drug development these days than actually on discovering new mechanisms.
During the lockdown, you've talked about you were fairly busy, unlike the coach, but I believe you're also doing some research on COVID and the effect that that's had on the brain. What are you seeing out of that?
So this is something we got very early interested in when, you know, there were pretty early on, one of the first symptoms that that I realized or people report is that loss of smell, which is a neurological symptom. And then today there's a lot of talk about brain fog and these things. So clearly there's effects on the brain. And there's a study out of UK who says that the cognition is long-term affected in people who have not been hospitalized but had a COVID infection. So this sparked my interest. What happens if COVID hits a demented patient? Does it accelerate the disease? Does it induce additional effects that make the cognitive outcomes even worse? And all those we only begin to understand. And so
it's interesting because obviously there was a lot of deaths in aged care facilities, and I guess the language around it was they're just older and COVID affects older people. But I reckon that's a really good point. What did they die of? Did it progress their
quickly.
Dementia?
Yeah.
And so was it just something that happened as opposed to them just being old? Have you seen anything with that? How far have you got with it?
We are in the process of publishing some interesting work about how neurons react to infections and how neurons react to the processes of even virus replication happening inside them. And we see changes to cognition. We see changes to activity patterns, which we really are at the beginning of understanding. So I think this will keep us busy for a few more years. But the team around the COVID and the brain is growing in our center.
So you and your wife, Lars, she's a professor as well. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah.
So do you still work closely together now?
Yes, we do.
Yeah?
And are you still married?
difficult question.
See, the Germans,
because I know I worked with my ex-wife and we're no longer married, so...
Yeah, well, the Germans do have a sense of humour, I can tell you. I've spent a lot of time in Germany. They've got a great sense of humour. So what's the next step for these breakthroughs in human trials?
The next step is really the commercialisation, and this is something we started about 2 years ago in setting up the frameworks to enable commercialization here at the university. And we're in the process of developing the gene therapies that we developed for motor neuron disease and for dementia into or towards clinical trials, I would say. This is probably the stage we are at.
And how difficult is that process?
You know, it's purely money-driven process. You know, the research very much depends on your input, on the team's collective intelligence. But the commercialization depends mostly on investors' willingness to spend money.
So is that just investors who then can make some money on the back end once you start selling this technology? Is that how it works?
That's ultimately a component of it. I guess you find investor groups who have a more human touch as well and are really interested in topic and making change in this area.
Philanthropists? Is that who?
There are some philanthropists who are interested in doing that for the greater good, but the majority are venture capital.
Do you form part of that group? Is it you that goes and walks the pavements talking to these people about it so you could put your sales hat on and kind of go, here's what we're doing? Or is that another division of the university?
It's both. So I'm part of this team, but there are, you know, finance people, the CEO around this. And I defend and explain the science. I don't make claims to understanding any of the rest.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Like, we're all in sales at some point.
I was just thinking, well, Lars...
You know, that's for the greater good. We all are.
Well, Lars sells the steak and you'd sell the sizzle.
Yeah.
Is that it?
I'd say so. I don't know what that means, but that...
That means that he sells the science and the sales guy sells the sizzle, you know, like sells the profit, the benefits of it.
Yeah.
You know what that means. You've been in sales long enough. I just love using that terminology.
A very dear friend and colleague of mine always refers to us as professional beggars. And because all we do our life is begging for money from funding agencies.
For research.
So,
yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Lars, you look like you're still a relatively young man. How much longer do you want to do this? Is this something you want to do for the rest of your life?
Yeah. I love what I'm doing. I fell in love with it from the first day I entered the laboratory. And, you know, I did research on a single protein, tried to understand how it split apart. That was all I was interested for 2 years. And I loved every moment of it. And I went back into the clinic. And don't get me wrong, I really liked helping people on the spot, but I loved and fell in love with basic science. And I know I'm super privileged that I can do every day what I love.
How about when you were at school? Did you have friends that were like you? Were you like-minded? Were you like this when you were younger?
You're referring to the nerds, huh?
I didn't say it. You said it. What do you call them in Germany? In German?
Yeah. There's a nasty word in German.
Oh, is it?
Yes, and, you know, there's a group of us who became very good friends during our upbringing at school, and we still connect every weekend online these days, and we live and work in different jobs and different places in the world.
Fantastic.
That's great, yeah. Isn't it?
The nerd's revenge.
Lars, we will definitely keep in contact with you and watch your progress.
Well, it is, because the research that they're doing obviously impacts on the NDIS in terms of the participants and you know, whether it be MND or epilepsy, which is on the list for NDIS, and younger dementia too. I mean, it's, you know, it said mum, when mum was in the aged care home, there was a woman who had full-blown dementia, and she was mid-40s. The work that Lars and his team are doing will absolutely help participants of the NDIS, so no doubt about it.
Would love to have you back again at some stage, Lars, and thanks so much for your time, and thanks for joining us on Coach and the Doctor. Doctor, I'd like Lars to say one thing before he goes. Lars, can you give us in your best German, Swiss German, or whatever, English, I'll be back.
Goodbye, you mean?
No, or? I'll be back.
I'll be back.
You just did it. I just wanted an I'll be back, Lars, because I just love that phrase. That's all. Thanks, mate. Thanks so much
for your time.
No worries. An absolute pleasure to talk to you guys.
Well, another great show. I know we say that every week, but I tell you what, they're getting better and better and better. I'm waiting for Hollywood to give us a call, Doctor.
No, look, you are getting better, and it's
taken me 35 years, or it's actually probably 40 years, but I don't want to age myself too much.
You'll be good at it one day, which is good.
They say 10,000 hours. I've probably had about 20 or 30,000. I'm nowhere near close enough. But thanks to both of our guests, and two more, of course, coming up.
Yes, who have we got next week, Coach?
Next week, I'm not going to say two great guests because that just goes without saying. But
two average guests.
Two average guests that could be great. Blake Cochran is a four-time Paralympian, exercise physiologist, and he's a speaker as well.
I was actually born without all my fingers and basically all my toes, and I've got a partial foot on my right foot as well, where I wear a prosthesis on that. For me, that's kind of where my journey began for who I am and where I've sort of come from with regards to that background of being a person with a disability.
And also Dr. Daniel Valiente Riedel, got his name right. He's the GM of an organisation called Job Access.
Job Access is a service that is funded by the Australian government. It is free for anybody, for any employer or any person with a disability that wants to approach us. And it's just there to remove barriers to the employment of people with disabilities. So we've got a four-prong service. We've got a phone service where anybody can call us and can get in contact with a psychologist, an occupational therapist, and experts around disability employment. And they can ask questions about what can be done.
I can't wait to hear that complete chat with Daniel, because he opened our eyes up, really, didn't he, on a lot of different topics, especially what the hell was Job Access doing?
Look, I didn't know a lot about it.
I think we have a chat to him about talking about the PR that they get or marketing, because they really need to let people know what they do, because it's absolutely outstanding.
So we won't give any more away. That's the next episode on Coach and the Doctor. I've got my calling card. What's your calling card to get out of this episode, Doctor?
Press hard 3 copies.
Press hard 3 copies. If you want to know what that means, listen to some previous episodes of Coach and the Doctor, and he explains it all. But for me, it's pretty simple. Coach out.
You've been listening to Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to Gildacare Support Coordinators. Gildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Gildacare.